offering a loving pranam at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari Shankar from the Shri Sathya Sai Central Trust. We are going through the 1991 summer course series as part of this session of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. We are going through the fifth discourse. These discourses, as many of you are following us regularly will know, is about the Upanishads. And the fifth one, especially the one we are going through, that is on the Keno Upanishad. And as you would have noticed, these discourses have been retranslated. What we are presenting now as clips have been retranslated and recorded so that the translation of these are more accurate and more clear. We've played about five clips so far, and we have, I think, as many more to go. So before we start this week's program with probably a very short summary of what we had last week and to see what Swami is going to tell us today, let's invite Brother Hari to join us. Sairam Hari.
Yeah, Sairam Hari. Yeah.
So the last time we played one clip, but that clip, I think, is on a topic which is very dear to Swami, and that Swami would often tell us, because it's a very common misconception that as you become spiritual, the lesser you should take care of the body.
Yeah.
You should give lesser regard to the body, but it doesn't equate to giving less care to the body. And, you know, that's a mistake which we often do. So this was almost entirely about, you know, that concept.
Yeah.
Where Swami is saying that, you know, what is held inside is so precious.
Yes.
Swami is equating the body to the iron safe, where the iron is not precious, but what it holds inside is, you know, precious. And it's almost like, even now we take care of the body. Not all of us, even though we claim to be living in the ashram, we don't neglect the body, really, in that sense. You know, be it the food we provide or the kind of clothing or whatever it is, there's no compromise in that. So when Swami says that this body is precious because of what it holds inside, you continue to take care of the body, but the perspective changes, and that's so very important, right? And in a way, if you look at it, it's almost like one thing is the way you take care of yourself changes, and the way you look at others also changes, because you no more look at the body as the most important component of the personality which is in front of you.
As in, like, most spiritual masters, and of course we see the theme in the Upanishads, which we mentioned earlier, there is aspect of balance also.
Absolutely.
See, everything, as Swami used to say, everything is within certain limits. Like, your sense enjoyment is within certain limits, sense deprivation also. See, none of it is meant for you to get carried away and do something extreme. So it's like, of course, the balance, how do we find it? Like, we are the best judge. Like we know, I'm very sure all of us know, like, when we are off kilter, right? So it's the same way I felt. Like, if you look at even the academic schedule that students follow, like, for me, when I moved from my engineering education to MBA education, like, there was a major shift which I could see, you know, in the where I studied my engineering. Like, most of the emphasis was on academics. There's hardly any attention paid to the other aspects. But the big change I see, like, I saw that when I came to Swami's Institute, was that so many, like, avenues for your self-expression were suddenly open to you. And Swami is to make sure that, you know, you participate in everything. That is, you should be a part of sport, so you take care of your body. Culturally also, Swami used to call, you remember, in the Kulwanthal, suddenly he'll call you and make you speak. So he would develop that oratorial abilities or your cultural, like singing, dancing, theatrics, right? All of these he used to develop, right? So in that sense, like, Swami was really looking at fulfilling your entire potential as a human being.
Right.
So that, I saw that shift in emphasis. You know, the wholesome education, when they say, I saw that actually being practiced in the institute.
In a way, if you look at it, when we used to, say, prepare for some of our big exams, the 10th boards, the 12th boards, probably that's the time we would have studied more than the rest of our life. Yeah. At least for people like me, I can say that.
Yeah.
You know, even then, you have this big exam coming and you're really studying hard. Your parents will always encourage you to probably go out for half an hour or 1 hour a day and, you know, play a game or just take a stroll out in the garden and come or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If you equate, like as a student, the most important thing coming up is that exam.
Mm.
So all that I have to use my time for is to study.
Yeah.
But even in that, there is this logic that allowing yourself a little bit of reprieve from that is going to enable you to be better prepared for that exam.
Yes.
Right? It's almost like that. You know, many people when I tell them I come from Puttaparthi and Swami's ashram, they say, what do you do other than doing bhajans and meditation?
Mm.
So because we, you know, in our illogical idea think that a student who is preparing for an exam should always study, we think anybody who has a spiritual goal should always be doing what we call spiritual activities.
Yeah.
But Swami is saying it's not like that. You know, you keep your goal is very clear in front of you, but you take your entire system along. You take your mind, your body and, you know, the whole of it along. You can't afford to leave anything behind.
Yeah. Actually, one idea that I find very close to this, the concept that we are talking about is the aspect called mindfulness, which they speak about in Zen. I think, like, Swami used to call it constant integrated awareness.
Right.
So, it is like, you know, so whatever you are doing, the job at hand, you do it fully, completely.
Mm.
So, which includes, like, so taking care of your body is, you do it fully and completely. If you are studying, you do it fully and completely, right?
Mm.
So that is something, you know, I like your relationships, right? Mm. So when at home, like Swami used to emphasize, like you should treat your mother and father as God, right? So there is like for him, everywhere you looked at, he wanted, you know, that light of awareness to fall on it and illuminate it.
Mm.
You know, rather than darken it. Like so that is how I look at it. Like for a he had that razor sharp awareness, right? And so whatever he looked at, so what manifests in leaders as attention to detail, right? Or, you know, that very meticulous about certain things. I remember, like, you know, one of my classmates, he said this, you know, when they used to enter into the interview room. Swami used to be very particular that the door should be closed like very, very gently.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't bang the door. You shouldn't hear the slamming of the door. Right? Swami was it was almost as if he's treating that door as a living thing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He used to say, when you close it carefully. And I remember if Swami called us into the interview room, Swami would be, you know, not for his sake, he used to be very conscious, like, whether we are observant of his needs and we switch on the fan ourselves. And while going out, whether we switch off the fan, you know. So all these very minor things. But he used to have such attention to detail. Right?
Right.
So that, I think that comes directly from the fact that, you know, this God is awareness. Right?
Right.
Divinity is awareness.
And talking about what you're saying about, you know, that balance, that right equidistance from complete deprivation and complete pampering of the senses.
Yeah.
You know, one hand Swami is saying the human body is just a container and it has to be given importance because it's a container.
Yeah.
And in the same breath, Swami is also saying, in the same clip which we played last week, Swami is also saying that Jantu Nam Narajanma Durlabha.
Mm.
He's saying it's just a container and, you know, it's an iron safe, it's a copper safe or whatever it is.
Mm.
But it's very precious because it's a human form.
Yeah.
So he's saying that though the human body is just a container,
yeah,
but because it's a human body, it's more precious than probably it's any other animal or bird form.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think many times Swami would say this, what differentiates an animal from a man is that aspect of discrimination.
Yes, yes.
So you can't talk of, you know, taking good care of the human body and using it for the purpose it's given without factoring in what we call discrimination. What is right and wrong, how much is good and, you know, when does it go out of hand.
Yeah.
So I think that's where that balance part comes, you know, where you can't overstep this idea of taking care of this body.
Yeah.
Because Swami is saying that towards the end of the clip which we played, you know, Swami says that how long will you take care of this body? Till the truth is reached.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost, I think, I don't know how many more years it's going to take for us. But at least you know that you're keeping your goal as till the truth is reached. You know, whether it's going to happen today, tomorrow, or decades later.
Yeah.
You kept your goal as the truth has to be reached, whether or not you're working towards it or not. The moment you place that as your goal, it's supposed to define all your decisions that you take, you know, in the run-up to that. And, of course, there's another thing which Swami said towards the end of that. You know, he was giving the example of you searching within. And, you go into a room, you go into a storeroom, and you search for objects. The only object you won't be able to find is yourself, because the one who is searching will not be able to find himself. Probably Swami is going to talk more about it. But I often wonder, what do you mean by turning your vision inward?
Yeah.
And if somebody were to ask you, what is it to turn your vision inward?
Yeah, I think, like, again, speaking from the point of view of awareness, in every action, every thought, you know, that we do, there is this very American expression, like, which says, like, where is it coming from?
Okay.
You know, like, so many of the methods of meditation which are taught, at their core, at their heart, they're essentially watching yourself. Right, so the many of us, as Swami used to say, most of our lives are what? Reflection, reaction, and resound.
Right.
So for all practical purposes, the way we lead our lives is basically a like stimulus response. You know, it's completely automatic. There's almost like machine. You know, there's very little of our own. You know, who we truly are,
right,
getting expressed ourselves. But and lot of these are brain patterns which have got created. You know, from your childhood. And as you grow, right? So, so we basically responding to that, you know, like the brain, you know, stimulates some response, and we execute it, so to speak. So in that sense, we almost have like the roles are reversed, master slave, right? So although we would like to think that whoever we consider ourselves to be is like we are the masters of our brain, right? But I think most of the time it's the other way around, right? So the moment we start becoming aware, like where we come from, like that is to say, when we're doing a certain action, like who are we, like, you know, who are we being while doing that? Like a very simple example. See, oftentimes a manager, right? Sometimes, let's say that he has a subordinate who is like sometimes very rude or not. You know, he has spoken harshly, or they've had sometime in their life they've crossed paths, right? So he has annoyed the boss for whatever reason, right? Now what happens is, while you're in a professional role, okay, so you encounter that same person as your subordinate. Now how do you deal with him, right? The ideal, most of us would consider the ideal way is to, you know, be a professional. Keep your feelings aside and just, you know, look at the job that has to be done and be impartial. We can look at it another way. Like, so actually within us there are like several people, right? We are in several roles simultaneously. So when you're sitting in the role of a boss or of the leader of an organization, you're no longer the individual that you are. Now you're suddenly a whole different person, right? So if we can bring that awareness, right, if like at that moment when this decision time comes as to what is the action I've got to execute, right, whether, so the temptation would be now is the time for me to take revenge, you know, maybe transfer him or block his promotion. These are the human ways of thinking, right? We like to dominate people, who are beneath us. But true leadership is like when you can be bigger than that. And the only way you can be bigger than that is to be aware of where you're coming from. Who are you being right now? Who do you need to be right now? Do you need to be that individual who is recalling the past of, you know, that something he has done to me and I need to take revenge for that? Or are you being a leader? Right? You're stepping into the role of a leader. Am I being that leader? Right? So that requires an approach which is not entirely inward. Right, and it's like, again, when I say balance, see, most of us, we lead our lives like either completely outward, right, never you know, looking, reflecting, or being absorbed or contemplating, right, or we are entirely in our heads, right? We are so not responding to situations outside, totally how do you say, detached from whatever is going on around us. So the balance is like, you know, it's a very razor sharp balance, like So you're simultaneously like half outside, half inside, so to speak. I think that is, in my view, like somehow in my mind, that is the image I have of what it means to be like aware. Right. Like.
And I was thinking when Swami says this here, how do you turn your vision inward?
Yeah.
Especially when Swami is talking about, there is this analogy which he's giving where he's saying that you have a torchlight and you're looking at the path and you're walking. Very similar to what we do in life. One thing which Swami very often say, a term which he uses is, man is Ananda Pipasi. He's always after happiness. So here he is out in the world and he's looking at all these objects. And there is this constant experimentation going on. I get this, I'm happy. I get this position, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I get this situation in life, I'm happy. If I'm put in this situation, I'm uncomfortable. So there is this constant reprogramming in the mind of what are the things which gives me happiness, what are the things. But it doesn't happen consciously. I mean, you're just there like an animal which is sent out to find game, you know. You're just being driven by your senses, driven by your smells and your hunger or whatever it is. It's almost like Swami saying that, I mean, factor number one, you're looking after looking for happiness. And for a moment, stop and see what is happening inside you. You know, you go after an object. Let's say you buy a phone. I always say this because I think we all go through it so often nowadays. You buy a mobile phone. You observe yourself how long that excitement of a new phone lasts.
Precisely.
You know, you observe yourself. I mean, you don't need a spiritual master to come and say, tell you. You will know that, okay, it is short-lived. But still you will be after your second phone, you know, the next upgrade comes, you will be like, I want to get that. But at least you have factored in this idea that, you know, this is, you know, short-lived. At least you have put in that idea. I think over a period of time, you're observing your changes within when you're put in a certain situation. You know, things like how authority changes your personality, how power changes your personality, how you know, your economic status changes your personality. You're at least aware. And of course, you can't do, as you said, doing this looking within without looking at others and observing them. I think it has to be done simultaneously, as somebody put it beautifully. You know, if the person who learns from his mistakes is a man with common sense. But an intelligent man learns from others' mistakes. So your life is too short to make all the mistakes yourself. So it's almost like, but you're looking at it from a inside out manner rather than from, you know, outside inside. I don't know, but maybe you'll have to, it's a lifelong process. It's not like, it just has to be made as a way of life, literally. So I think this is where Swami stopped last week, but we are in the, you know, threshold of a story which Swami is going to say, and in more ways, I think this is the central story in the Upanishad.
This is it.
Right?
And
probably, since we have taken so long to come to the story, maybe we should tell in what context it comes in the Upanishad, because Swami is talking about how, you know, you're not the senses. The one who sees is different from one who sees through the senses. I mean, the senses is different from the one who sees through the senses.
Right. Almost at the beginning of the discourse, Swami gives a prelude to this story, and in fact gives us the essence of the story, that when he says that while we take the senses to be the, you know, primal, like, you know, because they are manifest, they are what we can perceive, they are almost tangible to us, but but we never contemplate as to like what is driving those senses, what is energizing those senses, and then Swami adds a little twist, but I think like we can listen, all of us listen from Swami's golden voice.
I think we'll go to that clip, and it's always a delight to listen to any story from Swami, because you know, we all know Swami staged his first drama at the age of 8 or 10, right? You know, that's always that drama element. As you said, there's so much of difference from reading it in the text and listening to Swami.
Listening,
you know, there's so much of animation in Swami's voice. So, dear listeners, we'll go to the clip where Swami is narrating the story, which is in many ways the central theme of the Keno Upanishad.
Once upon a time, when there was a war between the gods and demons, declaring that they had won, the gods were observing a celebration of victory.
The మాకు విజయం సంభవించినది ప్రాప్తించినదని అహంకారంతో విర్రవీగుతూ వెర్రివారి వరే గంతులు వేస్తూ వచ్చారు.
ఇన్ దిస్ సెలబ్రేషన్స్, నాట్ రికగ్నైజింగ్ ద ట్రూ కాజ్ ఫర్ దేర్ విక్టరీ, దే స్వాగర్డ్ అరౌండ్ విత్ ద ఈగో దట్ దే హ్యాడ్ ఎమర్జ్డ్ విక్టోరియస్.
అహంకారంతో వీర విహారం సల్పుతూ వచ్చారు.
ఈగోయిస్టికలీ దే ప్రొక్లెయిమ్ దేర్ వాలర్.
ఈ సత్యాన్ని గుర్తించినటువంటి యొక్క బ్రహ్మ
హూ నోటిస్ దిస్ ఫ్యాక్ట్,
వీరికి కేవలము జ్ఞాన నేత్రములను తెరిపించాలని,
టు ఓపెన్ దే ఐస్ ఆఫ్ విజ్డమ్,
సత్య ప్రబోధను సలపాలని,
టు ఇంపార్ట్ ఎ లెసన్ ఇన్ ట్రూత్,
ఆత్మానంతమును చేకూర్చాలని,
టు కన్ఫర్ ద బ్లిస్ ఆఫ్ ది ఆత్మ,
ఈ అంధకారమును దూరము గావించాలని,
టు రిమూవ్ దే ఇగ్నోరెన్స్,
సంకల్పించుకుని యక్షు రూపమును ధరించి వారి ముందు నిలిచాడు.
హీ డిసైడెడ్ అండ్ అపియర్డ్ బిఫోర్ దెమ్ టేకింగ్ ద ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ ఎ యక్ష ఆర్ ఎ సెలెస్టియల్ బీయింగ్.
ఈ యొక్క అహంకారంతో వీరవిహారం జరుపుతున్నటువంటి ఒక అగ్నిదేవుడు ఈ యక్షునికి ముందు వచ్చాడు.
అగ్ని, ద గాడ్ ఆఫ్ ఫైర్ హూ వాస్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ ఈగో, కేమ్ బిఫోర్ ది యక్ష.
అతనిని చూచి యక్షుడు, నాయన నీవెవరు అని ప్రశ్నించాడు.
సీయింగ్ హిమ్ ది యక్ష క్వశ్చన్డ్, సన్ హూ ఆర్ యూ?
ఓ వ్యక్తి, నేనెవరో నీకు తెలియదా? నీకు తెలియకపోయినప్పుడు నేను చెప్తాను విను. సమస్త ప్రపంచమును కూడాను క్షణంలో భస్మం గావించేటువంటి యొక్క శక్తి కలిగినటువంటి యొక్క మహావీరుడను, నా పేరు అగ్నిదేవుడు అన్నాడు.
హే యూ, డోంట్ యు నో హూ ఐ ఆమ్? లిసన్, ఐ విల్ టెల్ యూ. ఐ ఆమ్ ద వాలరస్ వన్ హూ హ్యాస్ ద పవర్ టు రిడ్యూస్ టు యాషెస్ దిస్ ఎంటైర్ క్రియేషన్ ఇన్ అ మోమెంట్. మై నేమ్ ఇస్ అగ్నిదేవ.
ఇనుము కాదు, ఇంకేమైనా కూడా సరే, ఒక్క క్షణంలో నేను కరిగిప్పచేసేటువంటి యొక్క భస్మం గావించేటువంటి శక్తి నాలో ఉన్నది అని అహంకారంతో విర్రవీగాడు.
ఐ హ్యావ్ ద పవర్ ఇన్ మీ టు మెల్ట్ అండ్ బర్న్ డౌన్ టు యాషెస్ నాట్ ఓన్లీ ఐరన్ బట్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్, హీ అరగెంట్లీ డిక్లేర్డ్.
ఈ అహంకారం నిర్మూలం గావించాలని సంకల్పించుకున్న బ్రహ్మ చిన్న గరకపోసను తన ముందు వేసి, ఓ అగ్నిదేవుడా, దీన్ని కాల్చి చూస్తాము అన్నాడు.
బ్రహ్మ, who had decided to remove this ego of Agni, threw down a blade of grass and said, O Agni Deva, burn this, let us see.
ఇది ఎంతటి పని అని అలక్ష్యంతో దాన్ని కాల్చడానికి ప్రయత్నించాడు.
This is not much of a task, thought Agni haughtily and tries to burn it.
కాని ఎంత ప్రయత్నించినప్పటికీ ఆ గరక పోచును ఏమాత్రం కూడా కాల్చలేకపోయింది అగ్ని.
However much he tried, he couldn't burn that blade of grass.
తన యొక్క సర్వశక్తిని కూడాను ఉపయోగపెట్టాడు.
He used all his strengths.
కానీ నిరుపయోగమైపోయింది.
It was all in vain.
దీనితో తల వంచుకొని అగ్నిదేవుడు వెళ్ళాడు.
Hanging his head in shame, Agni went back.
తదుపరి గాలిదేవుడు వచ్చాడు.
Next came the god of wind.
వచ్చి, అయ్యా నేను గాలిదేవుడను.
Sir, I am the god of wind.
నా యొక్క గాలి వీచినప్పుడు సముద్రములే కాదు ఉప్పొంగిపోయి గ్రామములు, పట్టణములు, పల్లెలు, గుట్టలు, చెట్టు కూడాను ఒక్క తలక్రిందులుగా మార్చగలను.
When I blow wind, not only the oceans rise, villages, towns, hamlets, trees, hills, everything would turn topsy-turvy.
ఉప్పని చేత జగత్తులో జరిగేటువంటి యొక్క ప్రమాదములు నీకు తెలియదా? ఇవన్నీ కూడా నా మహత్యమే అని అనేక రకములుగా గర్వాన్ని తాను ప్రకటిస్తూ వచ్చాడు.
Don't you know the disasters caused by cyclones and storms? They're all my glory. He spoke thus arrogantly.
Oho, antar shaktivantulava, aithe ee garikapochunu kadirinchamani cheppadu yakshudu.
The yaksha said, are you so mighty? If so, move this blade of grass.
Kaani tana shaktini praveshapetti enni vidhamulago kudanu taanu prayatnam salpadu kaani danini kadirinchaledu.
Despite using all his strength and trying in different ways, he could not move it.
Intalopala Indrudu vachadu.
Meanwhile, Indra came.
Anaga Indrudu vachetappatiki aa yokka sthanamlandu unnatundi yokka yakshudu antarthanamayyadu. Aa sthanamulopala oka stree vachi nilchindi.
When Indra came, the yaksha disappeared and in his place manifested a lady.
Chuchadu Indrudu.
Indra saw this.
తల్లి, మీరెవరు? ఇంతకు పూర్వం ఉండినటువంటి వారెవరు? ప్రశ్నించాడు.
He questioned, Mother, who are you? And who was the person who was here before this?
నా పేరు ఉమా.
My name is Uma.
పూర్వం ఉన్నటువంటి వాడు బ్రహ్మ.
The person here before me was Brahma.
మీ అహంకారం మితిమీరి పోవటం చేత మీ అహంకారం నిర్మూలం గావించి కేవలము స్వస్వరూపాన్ని దర్శింపచేసే నిమిత్తమై మీకు సుజ్ఞానమును బోధించే నిమిత్తమై అతను ప్రత్యక్షమయ్యాడు.
As your arrogance had crossed the limits to destroy your ego, to reveal to you all your true form and to impart wisdom, he appeared.
అహంకారం ఉండినంత వరకు స్వస్వరూప దర్శనము ప్రాప్తించదు.
Till there is ego, one will not secure the vision of one's true form.
కనుకనే యక్షరూపమును ధరించాడు.
That is why he donned the form of a yaksha.
యక్షరూపమును ఉన్నటువంటి బ్రహ్మను కూడా మీరు బ్రహ్మగా భావించుకోలేకపోయారు.
You all failed to recognize Brahma in this form of a yaksha.
కానీ ఈ ఇంద్రియములకంత అధిపతి అయినటువంటి వాడు గనుక నీవు ఇంద్రుడు, ఈ నిప్పు నీళ్లు గాలి ఇవన్నీ కూడా నువ్వు కేవలము సెన్సెస్, ఒక ఇంద్రియములతో సమానం. వీటన్నిటికీ అధిపతి అయినటువంటి వాడు నీవు.
You are Indra, the master of the Indriyas or senses. The fire, wind and other elements are merely equal to the senses. You are their lord.
నీవు కూడాను ఆ యొక్క బ్రహ్మ దర్శనమునకు ఏమాత్రము అర్హుడవు కావు.
Even you don't deserve the vision of Brahma.
కనుకనే ఆ బ్రహ్మ అంతర్ధానమై కేవలము నేను, నీవు ఇంద్రుడు, కనుకనే నీవు వాంఛా స్వరూపుడుగా ఉంటున్నావు.
Hence, Brahma disappeared and I came. You being Indra, you are the embodiment of desires.
Desires. ఈ డిజైర్ ను, నీ యొక్క వాంఛనను నిర్మూలం గావించే నిమిత్తమై వాంఛా స్వరూపిణి అయినటువంటి స్త్రీగా నేను ప్రత్యక్షమయ్యాను.
To destroy the desires in you, I have appeared as a woman, the symbol of desire.
ఈ రూపమునైనటువంటి యొక్క పావము చేత, ఈ ప్రబోధన చేత, ఈ యొక్క దేవతలు తమ తమ అహంకారమును కొంతవరకు నిర్మూలము గావించుకుని కన్నులు తెరచి జ్ఞానోదయం కలిగి బ్రహ్మను గురించి ప్రార్థిస్తూ వచ్చారు.
బికాస్ ఆఫ్ ద లెసన్ రిసీవ్డ్ ఫ్రమ్ దిస్ ఫార్మ్, ద గాడ్స్ రియలైజ్ దేర్ ఫాలీ టు సమ్ ఎక్స్టెంట్. దే ఐస్ ఓపెన్డ్, విజ్డమ్ డాన్డ్, గివ్ అప్ ఈగో అండ్ దే మెడిటేటెడ్ ఆన్ బ్రహ్మ.
కేవలము దేవతలు ఇంత శక్తి ఉండినప్పటికీ ఒక గరకపోచును కదిలించలేకపోయారు.
ఇన్ స్పైట్ ఆఫ్ పొసెసింగ్ సచ్ పవర్స్, the gods could not move a blade of grass.
ఇలాంటి శక్తి అనేటువంటిది ఎక్కడ నుంచి ఉంటున్నది?
Such strength, where from does it come?
మానవుని యందు ఉండినప్పటికీ ఈ అహంకార మమకారం అనేటువంటి దాన్ని కేవలము అన్నిటినీ కప్పిపుచ్చి తన యొక్క స్వస్వరూపాన్ని కూడా మరుగు చేస్తూ వస్తుండాలి.
Though it is within man, ego and attachment conceal it and also makes one forget one's true nature.
అప్పుడు ఇంద్రుడే తల వంచి,
ఇంద్ర దెన్ బెండింగ్ హిస్ హెడ్ డౌన్,
కదలదు నీదు సంకల్పము లేనిదే గడ్డిపోచయును.
అది నిజు ననగనేల పిపీల కార్య బ్రహ్మ పర్యంతము నీవే, అది ఎరుంగరు మదిగలంగరు ముదము జందరు భూమిని కొందరు వివేకమున వర్తించదరిన విజువిజవిగీతలు కాని కడకు ఏ గతిని బట్టెదరో తెలియజాలరెంత వారలైన కదలదు నీ దుసంకల్పము లేనిదే గడ్డిపోచయును. అదియు నిదియు ననగనేల పిపీలకాది బ్రహ్మ పర్యంతము నీవే, అది ఎరుంగరు మదిగలంగరు మధుమ జందరు భూమిని కొందరు వివేకమును వర్తించడని కడు విర్రవీగదరు కాని చివరకే వేళకేది సంభవించునో తెలియజాలరు ఎంత వారలైన.
వితౌట్ యువర్ విల్ A blade of grass cannot move. One cannot declare that you are this or that. You alone pervade all beings, from an ant to the Brahman. All don't realize or recognize it or experience. Some on earth arrogantly feel they are wise, but none can know what happens finally. However great one may be, without your will, a blade of grass cannot move.
O Bhagavantuda, enni telivi cheta nundi prayojanam emti?
O Lord, what is the use of all knowledge?
Enni shakti samarthyam nundi prayojanam emti?
What is the use of all the strength and valor?
Entati vidyavantudai enni prayojanam emti?
However learned one may be, what is the use?
ఎంతటి ధనకనక వస్తువాహనాదులతో ఉండి ప్రయోజనం ఏమిటి?
What is the use of possessing so much money and material?
ఎంత ధనబలము భుజబలము బుద్ధిబలము ఉండినప్పటికీ నిన్ను తెలుసుకునేటువంటి బలము లేనప్పుడు సర్వ బలము కూడాను దుర్బలములే అన్నారు.
It is said, no matter how much power you may possess, be it the power of wealth, physical or of knowledge, when the power to know yourself isn't there, all powers become weaknesses.
నిన్ను తెలుసుకొనుటకు ప్రేమ బలము ఒక్కటే తప్ప భక్తి బలము ఒక్కటే తప్ప ఇంక ఏ బలము కూడాను నిన్ను తెలుసుకొనుటకు సాధ్యం కాదన్నారు.
It is not possible to know yourself through any other strength or power other than the power of love and devotion.
ఈ భక్తి బలమునకు మించినటువంటి బలము మరొకటి లేదు.
There is no strength greater than that of bhakti.
కనుకనే భక్తి అనగా ఏమిటి?
So what is bhakti or devotion?
Bhagavantuni nisvarthamainatundi hrudayamuto nirmalamaina bhavamuto nirahankaramainatundi chittamuto preminchatame bhakti.
Loving God with a selfless heart, pure feelings and a mind devoid of ego is bhakti or devotion.
Kanuka manavuni yokka shakti samarthyamulu indriyamulu yandu e maatram kodanu ledu.
Therefore man's strengths are not inherent in the senses.
ఆ ఇంద్రియములు కేవలము బ్రహ్మ బలము చేతనే ఇంద్రియములు కూడాను తమ తమ పనులు తాము చేస్తూ వస్తున్నాయి.
Senses perform their duties drawing strength from Brahman or God.
కనుక మన ఇంద్రియములన్నీ కూడాను కారణములు అనేటువంటి యొక్క సత్యాన్ని మనం గుర్తించండి, పనిముట్లు అని భావించండి.
So understand that all our senses are instruments. Consider them as tools.
ఈ పనిముట్లను మనం అధికారంగా కర్తగా మారి దానిని సద్వినియోగంగా ఉంచుకునేటువంటి దీంట్లో మనం దాన్ని ప్రవేశపెట్టండి.
Taking the role of the master, we must put these instruments to good use.
ఈ యొక్క ఇన్స్ట్రుమెంట్ అనగా పనిముట్లు కూడా కొన్ని కొన్ని సమయం లోపల కొన్ని రకమైనటువంటి రోగములు కూడా ఏర్పడుతుంటాయి.
Even the instruments are prone to diseases at times.
అనగా ఈ పనిముట్లకు వచ్చేటువంటి రోగం ఏమిటి?
What kind of diseases come upon these instruments? There is a crowbar. This is an instrument too. Due to extensive usage, it may have become blunt. Becoming blunt is its disease. We need to throw that into the fire. Beat it with hammer, get it straight and sharp. For such a disease, only this kind of medicine would work out. Similarly, we have eyes. Eyes too have a disease. When the eyes are healthy, white appears white, black appears black, red, and yellow appears yellow.
కాని జాండీస్ వచ్చిందంటే అంతా పచ్చగా కనిపిస్తుంది.
But when we have jaundice, everything looks greenish.
అది ప్రకృతి దోషమా? కాదు కాదు, ఇంద్రియ దోషము.
Is it the fault of nature? No, it is the fault in the senses.
మన నాలుక ఆరోగ్యంగా ఉండినంత వరకు కూడాను తీపి తీపి కారం కారము చేదు చేదుగా కనిపిస్తుంది.
As long as we are healthy, sweet is sweet, spicy is spicy, and bitter is bitter to the tongue.
కానీ అందులోనే మలేరియా ఫీవర్ ఏమైనా వచ్చి చేరిందంటే అన్ని తీపులు కూడాను చేదుగా రూపొందుతాయి.
But when we contract malaria, everything that's sweet too tastes bitter.
కాబట్టి ఈ ఇంద్రియములంతా కూడా రోగాలతో కూడినటువంటివి.
So all these senses have their diseases.
రాగాలతో కూడినటువంటివి.
They have attachments.
భోగాలతో కూడినటువంటివి.
They have greed.
కానీ యోగంతో కూడినటువంటివి కాదు.
But they do not have yoga.
కనుక వీటినన్నింటినీ కూడా మనము కేవలం అరికట్టుకున్నప్పుడే గొప్ప యోగంగా రూపొందుతాము.
When we control all these senses, it turns out to be true yoga.
అది యోగ చిత్తవృత్తి నిరోధక యోగ పతంజలి సూత్రం.
That is why it is said in Patanjali Sutra, yoga is the control of the wavering of the mind.
కనుక మన ఇంద్రియాలను మొట్టమొదట మనం అదుపులో పెట్టుకోవాలి.
Therefore first and foremost we must have our senses under control.
మానవునికి ఉద్రేకాన్ని అనుసరించి ఇంద్రియాలను ప్రవేశపెట్టకూడదు.
Man shouldn't use his senses driven by its agitations.
దానికి తగినటువంటి శాంతమును బోధించాలి.
He needs to train it to be peaceful.
కాలమును తీసుకోవాలి.
One must take time.
నిత్యానిత్య పరిశీలన చేయాలి.
Discriminate between the eternal and the transient.
తదుపరి ఈ ఇంద్రియాలను ప్రవేశపెట్టాలి.
Thereafter, the senses have to be put to use.
అప్పుడే ఇది సరి అయినటువంటి రీతిలో వినియోగం జరుపుకున్న వారు అవుతాం.
Only then we would be ones who have used them appropriately.
విద్యార్థులారా, ఈ వయసు లోపల విద్యార్థుల యొక్క ఇంద్రియములు మహాసూటిగా దాటిగా ఉండేటువంటివి, ఘాటుగా కూడా ఉండేటువంటివి.
Students, at this age, the senses of the students are at its prime and are sharp. They are powerful too.
మానవుని యొక్క కన్నులు మహా పాపమైనటువంటివి.
Man's eyes are very sinful.
ఎప్పుడు చూసినా వీరిని వారిని వీరిని వారిని చూస్తూ ఉంటుంటాయి. ఇది దీని వల్లనే ఎక్కువ కర్మను కూడాను పాపాన్ని కూడాను అభివృద్ధి పరచుకుంటున్నాయి.
Whenever you notice, they keep looking at this person or that. It is because of this, the eyes accumulate karmas and sins.
So that was the clip, dear listeners, we played for you. And as we said, there is that beautiful story which Swami narrated, in many ways central to this theme of Keno Upanishad. But of course, the points which Swami made following that, very profound, to tell you the truth. It's not put in that way in the Keno Upanishad. You know, that's, I think, the way Swami presented it to us, which is more relatable from our state. Mm. Before we come to that, the story itself, because I think the highlight was that song which Swami sang, which is so sweet. But, I think this is one of the features of the Upanishads, in a sense, where some stories like this, which are there in Vedas, will be taken and made part of an Upanishad, which in many ways the Upanishad tries to relate this untold essence of the story. And I think that's what the Keno Upanishad does, where the initial part is about the theory, and then it takes the story, which is probably in some other part of the Vedas, and says that, you know, to convey this message, the story was put. So that's why they say that Upanishads is the Vedanta. It's like the essence of the Vedas, which comes as a culmination of the Vedas, right?
Yeah. This is a very allegorical story, and we'll find like different versions of this story in like various Upanishads. Yeah, and just to like go over the story once again, like essentially it is like trying to, you know, like it is as if the Indri, the senses, each of them are coming to know their limitations,
right,
and also acknowledging like really who their master is. But the interesting thing is that actually it is Indra who is supposed to be the master of the senses, and it is more a wake up call to Indra, like it is an awakening, like, so to speak. I think the story is supposed to awaken within each one of us the realization again, like, are we being driven by our senses as it really is, or do we, you know, like reclaim our authority that as masters of the senses, like, so that is why the final frontier of desire, you know, the Uma, like, actually when I read the Upanishads, I was not clear as to why goddess Uma appears in front of Indra.
Okay.
It is only now when I, you know, heard the discourse, it became clear. Like when Swami says that I have appeared to you as an object of desire. So that's when it really came together for me, right? So Swami is making clear that the reason why Uma appears over there, goddess Uma appears there, she says that I am appearing, and it's like the, you know, the Lord Brahma was here, but because of your absorption in the senses, your arrogance, right, that he left, and in his place I am standing here. So it is like a wake up call to Indra, to, you know, like, I think elsewhere we hear this story of how Lord Indra, he decides to actually, you know, lead a life on earth, and then he, for some reason, he chooses the life, I mean the life of a pig.
Right.
And, you know, he is found wallowing in the muddy waters by Narada, and, you know, Narada again reminds him of who he truly is. So we find this story, and poor Indra is at the receiving end in most of these stories. But yeah, it's, instead of viewing it like as a story as it is, like, I think the message that comes across is this, that, you know, like, while you're supposed to be the emperor of the senses, here you are like completely, you know, driven by them, a slave to them. So this is a reminder that you should reclaim that, your original position.
Yeah, I think, as you said, this representation of God as Uma coming there as the final frontier.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, if you look at it, the story of how Mother Parvati earns the place of being a consort of Lord Shiva. Now, that story itself is very allegorical in that sense, because here is the princess. When you say princess, you're talking about a person of wealth, a person of immense attainment and authority.
Yes.
And she wants to win the hand of Lord Shiva, who's always absorbed in nothingness. He's just there without any desire to live in a place of comfort, lost in meditation. So she is forced to go through this process by which, you know, she attains the same level of detachment, because that is the only thing which can attract him. You know, if you have a person who is attracted to wealth and comforts, you can attract him through that.
Yeah.
But here is a person who is attracted only through sacrifice. You know, because he's Yogeshwara. You know, only a person who is able to give up their own likes and, you know, attachments and reach a certain level of sacrifice can please the Lord. You know, and so she goes through this process of giving up all her desires and all of that. So in many ways, she is the final frontier. You know, if you want to get to the proximity of the Lord, this is the process you have to go through. You know, she stands there as that path which each one of us have to go through.
Right.
And that's why she says, you know, the Lord was here. You missed the Lord. Now you have to go through me. You know, because I am the example which is best suited for your position, because you're so lost in your abilities. And again, it comes to that. You know, here are we, in search of happiness. And this happiness, probably 1,000th or 1,000,000th of it can be experienced through the senses. And we are in this belief that you can get everything through the senses. So here in the story, you know, there is this dried grass which Lord Brahma is putting forth and saying that, can you blow it off? Can you burn it down? Can you wet it? And they find that none of them are able to do it. And that's the whole idea, that, you know, there is some state of happiness which is much beyond what your senses can get you. And, you know, that is being challenged. That is being put forth as a challenge, literally asking you to, you know, go beyond that.
Because actually it is a very relevant message even to the present day world. See, more and more, like in this society, we are trying to assert our own individual, you know, being. That is our ability to express and satisfy our desires, right? And in fact, it is sometimes looked down upon, a life of like, where you're, if you say ceiling on desires, like, you know, people would interpret that as suppression of desire. They say, why is suppressing your desires? You should, you know, indulge them. You got, like, you only live once, right? So you got to indulge them. So, as one, I really loved this thing that a divine master once said. He said, for most people, freedom stands for the freedom to do just whatever you want. So there should be no barrier between you and your enjoyment of pleasure. And that is taken to be freedom. Whereas he says, like, true freedom is you being free to do whatever has to be done. You know?
Exactly. I think one of the elders in the ashram was telling me this. You know, when we talk of freedom, we don't realize we're talking about the freedom of the ego. The ego should be free to do whatever it wants. But spirituality is about freedom from the ego.
From the ego,
You know, as you're saying, the freedom to do what has to be done, free from your pulls of...
Which is why there's so much emphasis. If you see the scriptures, the Gita, and most of, you know, what is Indian theology, a lot of emphasis is placed on dharma, your duty, Like, because they want us to pay attention to that. And because that is actually the true means of satisfaction. So somewhere I was reading this article about, you know, so many times, even in the spiritual context, we keep thinking about how can we attain happiness. And you find most of the new age gurus, they're trying to address that. How can you find happiness in your life? Whereas I was reading this essay, which really brought home that there are people who actually go beyond that and search for true meaning. And sometimes, like, supposing you are somebody who stands for, say, upliftment of the poor. When you stand for that, you're actually sacrificing, so to speak, your happiness, Because on the way to that, you're going to encounter, like, disappointment after disappointment, you know, or a lot of physically you'll be, like, weary, a lot of things. But with all that, like if you look at it from the point of view of happiness, you are depriving yourself of a lot of things and you are causing physical pain to your body, so to speak. But at the end of it, what comes is a lot of satisfaction.
Right.
So it completely overturns, you know, your definition of what is happiness.
Right.
So I think it really calls for a lot of introspection in that sense, right?
Absolutely. I think one probably a basic mistake which we do is when we define happiness, you know, we are actually referring to elation or probably a sense of feel good or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But when we talk of happiness as the sole driving force of you know, human nature, I think we're talking of something more of equilibrium or equipoise.
Equipoise. Yeah.
Where you're just there and, you know, you're not worried about the future, you're not troubled about the past. Literally, it's a state like that.
Yeah.
Where you're just happy being there. Mm-hmm. In that condition, you're not. You don't want it to be different from what it is.
Absolutely.
Or even if you want it to be different, it's only a sense of hopefulness.
Yeah.
Which gives you, which again gives you that same sense of equipoise and equilibrium.
True. Because in most of the times, as you very rightly mentioned, like, you know, life is it's not designed to really give you, it's not assured happiness, right? Like at any moment, situations could turn in such a way. You never know. You can never predict. So,
I think the American Constitution has that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every citizen is guaranteed the right to pursuit of happiness, not right to happiness.
Happiness. Yeah. But so, I think we end up like defining happiness as, I think, something you know, neuroscientists would call like dopamine, correlated with a release of dopamine. But I think when we talk of happiness in the context of spirituality, it is a state which we naturally belong in.
Right, right.
It's not something that can be taken away from us. It's not something, you know, that we lose. It's something that we become unaware of.
Right.
You know, that as a result of inattention. Mm-hmm. Right. So happiness, or rather, I think the word happiness now has
skewing our idea of the thing, right?
Right. It is a state of ananda. Right.
I would probably equate what we're referring to as more of shanti, actually, a state of
complete
peace.
Equilibrium.
Because that's why Swami would often say this statement, no? When Swami is describing himself, he says, shanti is my swabhava.
Hmm.
It's when Swami says that, it doesn't mean that that's his and not mine. I think that's all our state.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's a natural state.
Yeah.
And the whole process through life is not to find something, but is to find a way to get back to that natural state.
Yeah. Because that, I think most of us, when it's our natural tendency that we feel that by doing something we will become happy.
Right.
And that is a trap, right? Whereas what life calls upon us to do is to actually be happy and then express that in like wherever we are, you know, whatever we are doing.
Yes, I think one of the philosophers would put it, you know, what do you do to see? He said, what do you do to see?
Right.
There's nothing to do.
Yeah.
And he says, when the vision is unobstructed, the result is sight.
Absolutely.
You don't do anything. Correct. When the obstruction is removed, and there is sight.
Yeah.
Which means, in the absence of any disturbance, the sight is there. You don't do anything. So he says, it's the same thing with, you know, coming to the next point that Swami is making, love.
Same,
because love is your nature. He says, when the heart is unobstructed, love is the result.
Yeah. And actually, this is a brilliant turning point in the discourse.
Right.
Actually, just before that, like I was listening to Swami, you brought my attention to how Swami is, you know, singing this particular very pithy song. But the thing was, again, it came back to me that really a very dry subject, like jnana, you know, the Upanishads, something then inherently they're not, you know, joy-giving. Like, as you have to find the joy in that within your own being, as, you know, the message resonates within yourself. But here is Swami, like, speaking about it with so much animation. You could see that he's really passionate about it. You know, it's not like a guru giving a very dry discourse. This is what you have to do. This is... like it's completely animating him, you know, from top to toe. He's consumed by that.
Right.
We could see. I think that's what drew our, you know, attention to that to topics like this, which normally our mind would not go to. But Swami had his way, you know, of inducing us to contemplate on these things.
The we probably wouldn't have come to talking about love in this context at least.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, Swami is so effortlessly going, because
it's a switch.
In many ways, if you look at it, you know, when you say love,
yeah,
there is no other way you can define it other than the idea of oneness.
Yeah.
Either there is oneness, or there is an effort to create oneness where you think there is duality,
right,
which is nothing but trying to be possessive.
Mm-hmm.
So in both ways, I mean, the idea is, you know, when I say love somebody and try to possess that person, what you call possessive love,
right,
it only comes from the misconception that there is duality.
Right.
But in both ways, whether you look at it as duality or not, you're actually trying to create oneness in either by understanding it or by creating it, in doing something.
Mm.
But both ways, when you say that, when you talk of love, you're always talking about oneness.
Right.
And I think that's why Swami is so effortlessly saying that the only way you can see this oneness is, you know, love God. That's the easiest way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Krishna would say, goes through Sankhya Yoga and Jnana Yoga and all of that. And finally he says, Arjuna, you know, God is known through love. God is known through bhakti.
Yeah. Well, because we are at that point of the discourse where the students, the listeners, whoever is studying this discourse have come to that point where they're very clear that the senses are, you know, they what we have used them so far, or how they have used us so far, like that is not ideal, right? That there's something beyond. We're not really there as far as our relationship with the senses are concerned, right? So I think this Swami is now giving us the antidote,
right
so to speak. Now what do you do with the senses? Right. What are they really meant for? But as a prelude to that, Swami is introducing us to, you know, like the most effortless way of so-called managing the senses. Right.
Right. And of course, from here Swami starts going into, in many ways, the problems the senses face.
Yeah.
Once again, you know, when we talk about, when you're speaking about looking within, I think that's what it means.
Mm.
Just be an open-minded person and look at what the senses do.
Yeah.
Typical thing, I mean, as students of science, we all know these examples.
Mm.
Let's say that, there is a red box in front of me.
Mm.
But the same red box which my eye sees changes with the color of the room,
the
lighting of the room.
Yeah.
The lighting, suppose there's a red lighting in this room, the color which I perceive will be completely different.
Mm. Mm.
So what the senses perceive is so much dependent outside it.
Mm.
And Swami says, you know, when there is the examples which he gives you, when there is jaundice or when you have cholera, how the taste in the tongue changes, how the colors the eye sees changes.
Mm.
So he says, then how can you believe the eye?
Yeah.
Because the eye is also given to these malfunctions.
Mm.
And saying that, so take whatever the eyes, the senses feed you with a certain amount of discrimination.
Mm.
You know, don't look at that as truth.
Yeah.
And I think that is a very, very important point for this detached analysis which Swami wants
precisely
us to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's a form of meditation, right? Like where you observe your thoughts in a very detached manner. Like, so when you observe your thoughts, all kinds of thoughts are going to spring up, right?
Right.
With completely no judgment, right? So whatever comes, as someone would say, it's like very akin to the process of you standing on the pavement of a very busy thoroughfare, right? So you watch the vehicles go past, and your mind is observing them, or your eyes are observing them with a very detached sense. You're not really thinking of where are they headed, why are they this way. You're just watching it, right? So if one of the methods they teach is like this, to just observe like whatever is going on, right?
Right. And if that is about what you perceive, I think that's the whole thing. You know, we are so obsessed with what I hear, what I see.
Yeah, totally.
Situations become so much complex, you know, because a situation has so much of input in it, and our ability to see it. I think the whole story was about that.
Mm.
You know, your perception of what lies in front of you is not really given by just one sense.
Precisely.
Like, for instance, we were discussing about this a couple of weeks back in the afternoon satsang, you know, where we said we were studying about what is the sense of touch used for.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we know how crippled we would be if the sense of sight or hearing or smell is taken away. But what about the sense of, the skin, the touch?
Mm.
apparently the scientific study which says that a lot of our spatial idea actually comes from the sense of touch. Because when you're in a crowded place, when you're in a claustrophobic room, all of that, we think that it comes from our sight, but they say that a lot of it comes from the body, you know, sensing the pressure around you and the heat of the room around you. So much of it comes from that. But it's so silent that you don't really recognize that as an important input which comes. So any situation like that is so complex that one sense cannot give you all the details. And all of the senses together also gives you a very partial image of what lies ahead.
Yeah, because what the brain then does is like it strings together a
patching
story.
Patching up the whole thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. It'll simply interpolate. And pretty soon you're living in your own cocoon of reality.
Right.
So I think even that awareness itself brings with it a certain measure of freedom.
Right.
So even realizing that what we take to be reality, what we take to be truth may not be so, that itself frees us up a lot, you know, in our interactions with people.
I think that is what spirituality is all about. The ability to change your paradigm in day-to-day life. You know, it's not about going to one secluded place and sitting in. I think all of Swami's discourse is all about that.
Yeah.
Now, how can you bring this kind of thinking to your everyday life? When you're going out to work, when you're interacting with your children. How can you bring all this? Just observe yourself. Just observe what you're doing. Just observe what you're thinking and all of that. And of course, this one statement which Swami makes is very beautiful. He says, you know, talking about the senses, he says, there is greed in the senses. There is attachment in the senses. There is disease and confusion in the senses. But there is no yoga in the senses. But in the control of the senses, there is yoga. So it's almost like don't find, look for yoga in it, but by controlling it, the yoga probably which is within will start revealing itself. Literally, Swami makes that point here. But of course, after that, a practical thing which Swami says is don't be driven by the agitations of your senses. You need to train it to be peaceful. And you must take time, discriminate between the eternal and transient. I think this is very, very practical ways of, because all of us face this agitation of the senses, being drawn and pulled by our senses. Swami says, if you can do these three, then the remaining we'll see next week. That's what Swami says. So I think we'll, I think the time's up and we'll have to conclude with that. So dear listeners, thank you for being with us. And we actually played two clips today. We played them back to back. So we'll continue this discourse next week. This is the discourse which Swami delivered on 25th of May, 1991. But I'm tempted to, before going, leaving you all, to play that song which Swami sang again. So we're going to leave you with that. So do join us next week, dear listeners. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you. And as I said, as we go off, we're going to play for you that song which Swami sang in the clip which we played today.
Indra then bending his head down.
Kadaladu needu sankalpamule nide gaddi pochayunu. Adi nijina naganela pipila kari parimapariantamunive. Adi yerungaru, madigarangaru, mudamujendaru, bumikundaru, vivekamana, vartinchadana vijivigitarikani, kadaku yegatin bettadaru. తెలియ జాలరెంత వారలైన కదలదు నీ దుసంకల్పము లేనిదే గడ్డిపోచయును. అదియు నిదియు ననగనేల పిపీల కాది బ్రహ్మ పర్యంతము నీవే.